CFA News, I'm Kennedy Quayle.
And I'm Teresa Wersbianska for Pacifica Radio.
Welcome to Africa Now. Today's show features worker power and the legacy and impact of Ngugi wa Thiong'o. Africa Now is next. Welcome to the show. I'm Wiza Muntali. The music in the background is Work Song by Cannibal Adderley. Africa Now features a discussion on workers' power, worker solidarity, organizing workers, and more in the Southern U.S. with Ben Carroll, organizing coordinator of the Southern Workers' Assembly. The Southern Workers' Assembly is a network of local unions, worker organizations, and organizing committees committed to building rank-and-file democratic social movement unionism as a foundation for organizing, uniting, and transforming labor power throughout the South. Here is the conversation between Ben Carroll of the Southern Workers' Assembly and Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope.
Thank you for taking the time to join us today, Ben. And the conversation that we're going to be having is about an important summit that is coming up, spearheaded by the Southern Workers' Assembly. Maybe before we get into that, thank you for taking the time to join us.
Yeah, thanks so much for inviting me. I'm excited to talk a bit more about the summit coming up.
Before we get, you know, specifically into the summit, can we talk a little bit about yourself? Could you just introduce yourself and introduce the audience to the Southern Workers' Assembly?
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, my name is Ben Carroll. I live in Durham, North Carolina, and I'm the organizing coordinator for the Southern Workers' Assembly. And the Southern Workers' Assembly, we've been active for about the last 13 years. We were founded in 2012 in September as the Democratic National Convention was taking place in Charlotte as a counter-gathering to the DNC that brought together rank-and-file workers from the public sector, from food processing plants, from healthcare, from a variety of different sectors, as the Democrats were holding their convention in Charlotte, which, you know, many people know is the behind New York City and Wall Street is the second city with the second highest concentration of finance capital. You know, obviously the South is a region that's dominated by reactionary politicians and anti-labor, racist, reactionary laws. And North Carolina itself is a state with, you know, that year after year kind of goes back and forth with South Carolina as having the lowest union density in the country. You know, it's been cited by Oxfam and other international human rights organizations as having subpar and substandard labor laws, you know, despite the fact that CNBC ranks North Carolina generally at the top of its list as the best places to do business in. You know, the human rights organizations and labor organizations rank North Carolina at the bottom of the list for workers, which, you know, obviously there's no coincidence in those two, in, you know, that seemingly kind of contradictory dynamic. And so, you know, as the Democrats were meeting in Charlotte and, you know, as they do purport to represent the interests of working people, workers from across the region gathered to raise up and speak in their own voice, you know, to raise up workers' demands. And, you know, at that same time, too, the Charlotte City workers were engaged, you know, who are members and organized with UE 150, which organizes public sector workers across the state. They were engaged in a pretty pitched battle with the city council and had been for years to win dues deduction from their payroll. And, you know, with the attention of the world on Charlotte, the city workers and other allies, you know, were holding weekly demonstrations at the city council meetings and, you know, through that struggle and through, you know, really taking advantage of all the attention that was on Charlotte as a result of the Democratic National Convention being held there, we're able to win payroll dues deduction. And, you know, from that gathering, you know, I think there was a real recognition that, you know, there needed to be a formation that connected rank and file workers together across the region who were in motion, who were fighting, you know, on different battlefronts in different sectors, to be able to start to build a network across the region that can, you know, exchange lessons, that can coordinate around demands and make other interventions, you know, in the day-to-day struggle of the workers' movement. And at the same time, you know, start to build infrastructure that can lay the foundation for much needed organizing, or, you know, broader organizing across the South, and, you know, to be making, to uplift, you know, the fights that are happening in workplaces across the region, and make an argument and make a case to the rest of the labor movement and the social movements around the necessity of supporting worker organizing in the South. Because as we know, you know, the South is the least unionized part of the country, kind of the center of the most reactionary, racist, backwards politics, which, you know, again, there's a direct connection between those two things. And, you know, Southern workers, you know, across the board have the lowest measures of quality of life, you know, compared to any other region. But, you know, that doesn't stop at the kind of boundaries, you know, the impacts of the lack of organization in the region don't stop at the boundaries of the region, because corporations and capital is constantly using the fact that there's so much non-union labor in the South as a bargaining chip against other workers who are fighting for higher wages, you know, threatening to move plants, actually moving plants, so on and so forth. So, you know, the question of organizing the South, obviously, first and foremost, is a question that is directly relevant, and it will have immediate bearing on the quality of life and the working conditions and the political power of workers in the region. But it's, you know, intimately connected to the future of fighting and building a workers' movement that can change society for workers in other parts of the country and even across the world. So, you know, the Southern Workers' Assembly today has continued to build off of that initial kind of gathering and that orientation towards building these types of networks. There's a lot of different, you know, parts of the work that we're doing, but kind of at its core, you know, the SWA is a regional network of rank and file workers in different sectors that are organizing and building power at work. And we find, you know, different ways to connect, you know, these workers together through the local workers' assemblies, which are, you know, these networks on a kind of geographic level, through regional industrial councils. And we also, you know, like the summit coming up, hold regional gatherings with workers to really help to develop and shape those networks to, you know, emerge with some level of shared strategy, to do political education, and really just kind of build those connections across between workers across the region. And, you know, I'll conclude on this. I mean, I think, you know, the other piece that's kind of fundamental to our approach is that, you know, generally the labor movement today, you know, organizes in a kind of a shop by shop approach that's very dependent upon the National Labor Relations Board. And, you know, obviously we want all workers to have collective bargaining. And, you know, in this country, that's the process to do it. But, you know, we are kind of thinking is, and, you know, this comes from looking back through history at the moment, you know, the periods of upsurge and organization and militant struggles, whether it's the 30s and 40s, you know, the civil rights movement and so on, is that, you know, these movements and these kinds of big kind of upsurges of organization and various struggles happen kind of, you know, as a result of conditions that change very rapidly and the placement of different leaders and networks and, you know, that were communicating with one another, that were able to kind of take advantage as those conditions change. And we really see that, you know, as a strategy to build worker power, to build organization, to build consciousness in the South and across the country, to develop these cores of leadership or cadre within various strategic workplaces, you know, to connect them together through the various networks, you know, that I was just mentioning. And when there are those kinds of moments, those breakthrough moments where there's, you know, a dramatic change in condition and open conditions and an opening that workers can take advantage of to, you know, have those kinds of networks and those leaders in place that are practiced, you know, have, you know, trust and layers of coworkers around them to really be able to usher in the kind of sweeps of union elections and unionization, collective bargaining, and, you know, struggles that can really pave the way to building power in a long-term way and really, you know, fundamentally changing society.
Well, thank you for that. And SWA comes out of, you know, a lot of the groundwork that was laid by Black Workers for Justice, you know, and a number of other organizations that are looking to connect struggles that are happening in the community to the workplace as well. So that is a particular type of labor organizing that, you know, culminates into these assemblies, right? The local assemblies, using those as a platform the industry councils. Could you talk a little bit about the assemblies? How many assemblies does SWA currently have? And also the education, the councils themselves, how they fit into the strategy.
Yeah, absolutely. And just before that, I just want to touch on a point that you just spoke to around, you know, connecting the workplace fights to the community. And I think, you know, particularly in the South, again, just with how, entrenched the, you know, reaction is in the region, whether it's, you know, the politicians or the bosses, we really see that, labor struggles are not going to be successful in the region in particular, if they're not engaging and bringing forward the broader community. And in that sense, turning, you know, workplace struggles into and connecting it to a broader movement. And, rather than really confining workplace struggles just to the walls of one facility or, you know, this place or that place, really bringing the whole community in, connecting the issues in a workplace to the broader community, and really kind of imbuing this movement building sense. And in the same way that other social movements, you know, engage broad sections of society, seeing that the labor movement needs to really adopt that same kind of a methodology that is bringing in other sections of the community, building solidarity, showing the connections, and like really building workplace fights as an institution for power, for advancing broader demands of the community more generally, where workers themselves who are working in these places, you know, live and are building their families and so on and so forth. So, yeah, I think that that's also, you know, a fundamental part of our approach. And as you mentioned, it's really drawn from the work of Black Workers for Justice and UE 150 and others. But yeah, to your question, currently we have 15 different workers assemblies in various cities across the region, from Virginia to North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Tennessee, Texas, and a handful of others. And, you know, where the industrial councils that we've been developing so far include a service workers council, an education workers council, a gig workers council, a public sector worker council, and a manufacturing council. You know, a big objective of the upcoming summit, we are going to have a lot of time during the weekend where there'll be different sector specific breakouts and strategy discussions. And, you know, one of the kind of main pieces that we're hoping to emerge from the weekend with is, you know, strengthening the industrial councils that I just mentioned that are already operating in some way, helping to develop other councils as a basis to begin to connect workers across the region, you know, for them to develop a common identity, to find common issues that they can be, you know, coordinating around across the region, and as a basis to engage and connect together other workers in those sectors who are looking to organize across the region. And in that sense, kind of, you know, building out the network of various leaders that are spread throughout different important workplaces in these different sectors. That's kind of, you know, the core of our approach.
Talk a little bit more about, as we're leading into the summit, you mentioned a little bit about what's going to happen, the dates of the summit, where it's going to be, because as again, there's leading to, this is a step into multiple other objectives that SWA have in the context of organizing the South, and particularly workers. Talk a little bit more about the logistics of the summit itself that's coming up.
Yeah, so, we've been working on developing the summit now for the last probably 4 or 5 months with a number of different other worker organizations that are, have a base of workers in different strategic sectors across the region. And there's, you know, the SWA, the Southern Workers Assembly, initiated the organizing process, but, you know, it's brought together 16 different worker organizations. So I think, you know, even just the collaboration of the different, experiences, perspectives, building that unity through the process of developing this gathering together, I think has been quite powerful and, you know, an important advance in starting to, you know, develop and strengthen some of those connections that already exist, but really kind of particularly in this crisis moment that we find ourselves in, really kind of building that type of unity that we think is urgently needed. But, you know, the summit itself, the Southern Worker Action Summit, will be taking place in Spartanburg, South Carolina, starting on Friday, June 13th at noon, and wrapping up around midday on Sunday, June 15th. And It is, you know, going to be kind of a pretty packed, exciting weekend with a lot of different strategy discussions, you know, nuts and bolts, organizing trainings, political education, you know, sector and state-based breakouts and other, you know, other discussions throughout the weekend. But, you know, really kind of fundamentally, there's a couple of, you know, I think kind of core pieces that we're hoping to, for the workers that are going to be participating, to engage in various discussions around and emerge from the weekend with. And I think, you know, the first and foremost, obviously, is the period that we find ourselves in, where the Trump administration and the billionaire class that, you know, Trump and his cronies represent are, you know, just unleashing unprecedented attacks against virtually every section of the working class, whether it's migrant workers, federal workers, the attacks on Medicaid and Social Security. They really, you know, obviously they have a vision of society that is fundamentally opposed to our vision, and coming together to evaluate that, to share lessons from the different struggles workers have been engaged in, and to really start to strategize about what kinds of formations, what kind of fights can we take up, where can we exert the leverage, how can we, you know, wage the defensive struggles that are necessary in this moment, but also be thinking about how we can go on offense too. Connected to that, I mean, another kind of central question that we'll be discussing, and, you know, that a lot of the weekend will be focused around, is the question of organizing the unorganized, you know, thinking about various kinds of forms of organization, whether it's workers' assemblies, developing workplace committees, are there, you know, sector, take, you know, really doing assessment of the Southern economy, are there sectors that are growing, are there sectors in our cities or states where, you know, there's a, you know, huge capital investments coming in that are strategically important, you know, and taking up those questions and trying to emerge from the weekend with some, you know, shared sense of direction about how we're bringing that back to our workplaces, our communities, and really kind of, you know, putting front and center this question of building organization, you know, that is oriented towards, you know, developing a higher level of consciousness and engaging in collective action, and, you know, on the long-term road to building power across the region. And then, you know, the third piece too is thinking about what kind of infrastructure can we build? You know, a lot of times there's these kinds of conferences or gatherings that are great. You know, it's a great weekend. You learn a lot. You hear a lot of good talks, meet a lot of people that you stay in touch with. But that's kind of where it stops. And we, you know, we want this to be a gathering where all those things are true, but that it emerges with some real concrete things that are keeping people together, keeping people working together. I mean, the industrial councils is one of those things. I mean, we're also going to be having different state-based strategy meetings too, that will be kind of an anchor to keep folks together. You know, we're going to be talking about how to build workers' assemblies and workplace committees, which will be another anchor to keep people together. And then, you know, I think for us and, you know, many other groups too, you know, we've been thinking very seriously about this call that the UAW put out, you know, 6 months or so ago around lining up various actions towards May Day 2028. As really kind of a day and, you know, a sustained period, perhaps, of, you know, direct confrontations with capital, with, you know, the political forces that want to lower our conditions even further, take away rights, attack workers, and thinking about what do we need to do between now and then? You know, what kinds of activities can we be engaging in? What kinds of educational work do we need to be doing? How can we be engaging unorganized Southern workers in strategic industries, which there are many in the South? I was reading an article the other day that I'm probably going to get the figures wrong, but I think it was in the like 80s or early 90s, 45% of cars were produced in the Midwest, and there was no auto factories in Alabama. Now I think it's reverse, where there's 45% of cars are produced in the South, and Alabama, I think, is putting out the highest number of vehicles you know, per year. And that, and so, you know, that's just one of many examples of various important industries in the region. But thinking about how can we really think about in a serious way the types of formations and the type of work we need to be doing now to build and engage a wide swath of Southern workers in that motion and that activity and those mass actions that are being planned for May Day 2028. And so I think it'll be, you know, and in addition to that, you know, we're going to have, you know, a good amount of downtime for folks to, you know, connect with others, you know, exchange lessons, you know, meet people. We'll have, you know, different kind of social events and in the evenings, and we'll have culture mixed throughout the weekend. So we hope, and I think it'll be a really energizing an exciting and helpful experience that will have a lot of concrete pieces that we can continue to move on together coming out of the weekend, and that folks can bring back to their own workplaces and communities, you know, when they leave on Sunday.
So just to reiterate, this is, you know, this is the SWA Worker Action Summit that is happening, you know, June 13th through the 15th in Spartanburg, South Carolina. Information can be obtained. More information can be obtained at
It's southernworker.org/summit.
And so there are probably going to be, if you, I mean, on social media, you can go to SWA social media. Another, it's floating around, and there's a barcode, and not a barcode, the
QR code.
Yeah. QR code, my bad. Yeah. The QR code that gets more information. But again, if you go to the website, you can actually get more information. And before we conclude, Ben, I just want to just highlight or pull out that particular point that you're making about the transition, particularly around automobiles and the factories, manufacturing. And, you know, there has been a change in the landscape, particularly when you're thinking about electric cars and how that is on the horizon. And then, of course, there is the notion of the idea that you mentioned earlier, that the South is good for business, but not for workers, right? So could you talk just a little bit about why that is an important, not to disregard any other industry? This is not that, because we know that there's other industries that's going to pop up into this, particularly when you're thinking about, you know, the extraction of natural resources that goes into that, the processing of those natural resources, you know, all of that particular stuff. So that has been a fundamental change in the I guess, the local or regional political economy that's directly tied to the global economy as well. Did you want to talk a little bit more, you know, about that before we conclude?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think your point is absolutely right. I mean, every worker needs to, be organized. Every worker, should organize at work and connect with other workers to build power. I think as you mentioned, there's, you know, over the last 20, 30 years, there has been a real phenomenon of a lot of manufacturing, whether it's auto or tires, or, you know, more recently, it's a lot of pharmaceutical manufacturing, you know, the data centers that, you know, Elon Musk and all these, all techno whatevers are building all over the place. They're, you know, concentrating a lot of them in the region. And actually, you know, I think Spartanburg itself is, you know, kind of a prime illustration of some of the changes that have taken place over the last 30 years. And, you know, it's obviously, it kind of exists in, a national and global context. You know, a lot of these changes coincide with, you know, the passage of all these free trade agreements in the late 80s and 90s, the decimation of the textile industry in particular, which was, you know, pretty big in the South and, you know, in the North Carolina, upstate South Carolina area in particular. It's now been, you know, replaced in many respects with some of these big manufacturing. I mean, Spartanburg itself, the home of BMW's largest manufacturing facility in the world, and 60% of their over 60% of the vehicles they produce there are exported abroad. That's one example among many, many others. I mean, you know, whether it's auto or something else, you know, that's producing goods, these are huge profit centers. I mean, I forget where I read this or heard this, but Someone said recently that one of the auto plants in Alabama, I forget which one, but, you know, they produce however many hundreds of thousands of cars every year, and they make almost $1 billion in just straight profits, you know, which is money that should be going, obviously, first and foremost to the workers who are making these vehicles, but to the community. You know, this is money that's taken out of the community. It's sent to Wall Street, you know, to the company's shareholders, all this kind of stuff. But these big profit making centers, you know, when you can disrupt and interrupt their ability to make profits, you know, that's really kind of fundamentally the kind of key power that workers, you know, in any sector have, you know, to strike and withhold our labor. And so, you know, building organization in these huge, these corporations that are, you know, investing tremendous amounts of capital into the region, that in turn are making tremendous profits, and that are also getting, you know, huge handouts from state governments, you know, at a time that they're slashing budgets. I mean, all the different contradictions of society are kind of wrapped up in these different manufacturing facilities that are being opened and, you know, developed in the region. And, you know, the electric vehicle industry, I mean, too, that you mentioned, like a lot of these automakers, and, you know, obviously there's a lot of turmoil in the region right now with, the Trump administration and the, you know, the right wing and some of the changes that they're making. And, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty, but nonetheless, you know, they really view the region as a place that they can exploit workers, they can exploit the resources, they can get, you know, these sweet deals from the state legislators that give them just cheap land, cheap access to electricity, huge tax write-offs. And it's, you know, it's good for their bottom line. And that's kind of fundamentally the reason they're coming here. And at the same time, you know, these state governments use the fact that, you know, the South is dominated by right to work laws, that it's we're the least unionized region of the country as a selling point to attract these corporations to the region. And so, you know, building power, particularly in these profit making centers and these centers that, you know, are attracting these tremendous capital investments, you know, is really kind of one of the more fundamental ways that we can exercise a power that we can win and raise demands and do so in a way, you know, again, kind of going full circle back to, you know, kind of our broader orientation that, you know, obviously first and foremost reflect the interests of workers in a given workplace, but that, you know, increasingly reflect the interests of workers in a sector and, you know, workers as a whole, you know, connecting those issues across workplaces, connecting those issues back to the broader community. And really seeing ourselves as building a movement that represents the interests and is building power, not just for workers in a given facility, but for the working class as a whole. And, you know, I think particularly now with, you know, the broader political changes, these economic changes that are happening, it's a critical time for workers to get organized and for workers to, you know, for us to recognize too that we do have a tremendous amount of power. And really with the missing ingredient is our ability to be organized and to exercise it. And that's exactly what you know, the SWA, the other work organizations that are part of developing the summit, and the many others that are going to be there are interested in talking more about and making, you know, concrete plans to go out and build organization and build power.
And again, just for folk who are listening to this to get more information, what is the website again?
Southernworker.org/summit. And, you know, we do have another week or so that the registration will be open. The dates again are June 13th to the 15th. In Spartanburg, South Carolina. And, you know, for any workers who are listening or other folks who want to be a part of helping to build power in among unorganized workers, you know, we'd love to be in touch with you. Even if you can't make it out to the summit, you know, as you mentioned, we have, you know, workers assemblies in various cities. If you're in a place where there's not an assembly, we'd love to talk with you about developing one or building a committee at your workplace. So, you know, we hope that folks will reach out and get in touch. And, you know, we're excited to be with everyone in Spartanburg and to build together from there.
Thank you very much, Ben Carroll. It's been a pleasure, and I look forward to talking with you again.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
And that was a discussion on workers' power, worker solidarity, organizing workers, and more in the Southern U.S. with Ben Carroll, organizing coordinator of the Southern Workers' Assembly. The conversation was with African Owls executive producer and co-host James Pope. The music in the background is Think by Curtis Mayfield, and we play that remembering Curtis Mayfield's birthday, which is June 3rd. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW, 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now Africa Now remembers renowned novelist, essayist, playwright, journalist, editor, academic, and social activist, Dr. Ngugi wa Thiong'o, who joined the ancestors last week on May 28 at the age of 87. Longtime human rights activist and lawyer Maina Kiai reflects on the legacy and impact of Ngugi wa Thiong'o. The show also features from our archives a recording we produced of Ngugi wa Thiong'o at the December 2016 African Studies Conference discussing the politics of memory and the effects of name imposition on the psyche of colonized people. First, we'll hear Maina Kiai reflecting on Ngugi wa Thiong'o's legacy and impact. Maina Kiai is the former director of Alliances and Partnerships Program at Human Rights Watch, and is also former UN Human Rights Special Rapporteur. He's also founder of the Kenya Human Rights Commission NGO and founding chair of the Kenya National Commission on Human Rights. Here's my conversation with Maina Kiai recently. And following that conversation, you'll hear Nguyuwa Thiong'o at the December 2016 African Studies Conference discussing the politics of memory and the effects of name and position on the psyche of colonized people. Maina Kiai, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mwiza. Thank you very much. It's been a while, but it's good
to be
back.
While.
Yeah.
And sadly, we come to honor a great person.
Well, I'm not sure it's sad. It's sad that he's left us, but it's a big thing. It's a celebration of a really great person, a very impactful human being in very many ways.
Yes, right. Yeah, he was celebrating his life. Somebody who, he really lived life to the fullest, as you can say, and always making sure that he's speaking truth to power. But if you could just give us just a brief the impact of Nguyuwa Thiong'o in Kenya, where you are, and in particular, but generally also in the African continent.
Well, he was an icon in so many ways. He was larger than life in so many other ways. But it's hard to define his impact in a simple sentence. I think for many of us growing up in Kenya and many people growing up in Africa, our first meeting, if you wish, of Ngugi was through his books, his novels, his fiction. And whether it was The River Between or Weep Not Child and A Grain of Wheat, these were books that we were reading. And thankfully, actually, in that time, Kenyan educational system was moving away from the English system in English literature and had begun doing literature in English when I was going to high school. So we were fed books like River Between. In fact, I actually think River Between was a set book for our exams, our O-level exams. But there were other books that he wrote that we read. So he was the first introduction to Nguyuwa Thiong'o. And he was a person that even the teachers were very proud of because of his writing. So that's the first time you encounter him. Then soon after that, we encounter him as a person who is a political prisoner. He was detained without trial for about a year by Jomo Kenyatta. And we find that he's detained because he has moved from writing in English and began writing in Gikuyu, his mother tongue, and he was doing a play with ordinary people in the village he comes from. So he got this cast of ordinary people and they're doing this play, they were rehearsing, and they presented one day before it was banned, and then he was jailed without trial. And it was called, it's not in English, it's called I Will Marry When I Want. And it was highly political as well. But the book was about empowerment and trying to get local villagers, peasants, to see that they have some power over what's going on in their country, what's going on in their lives. And that was a big threat to the Jomo Kenyatta regime. So they banned the play, the screening of it, and then they jailed him without trial for a year. Then we next find him when he is come out of detention, released by Daniel Moi after a year. And soon after, there's this book called Detained, memoirs when he's in jail. And he wrote them on toilet paper, you know, by hand, and wrote a whole book about it. So he didn't write that. So the book on hand was Devil on the Cross, but he wrote on toilet paper. But he came out with a memoirs about the prison time, and he called that Detained. So we are rereading this, and you see, if you follow Ngugi, you see him evolving. First, from a writer of fiction who's analyzing and putting a mirror to our faces, looking at Africa and Kenya, first of all, from the colonial state and then the post-colonial state, challenging the colonial state, but all in writing in fiction. And then you see him evolving into actually probably what you can call an activist today, and evolving in a public activist and a public intellectual, writing articles and essays, and challenging the state. And so his book, Petals of Blood, was really the first real upfront confrontation with the state of Kenya, post-colonial state. And it was interesting in that sense. But then when he decided that he's never going to write fiction in English again, he's going to do it in Gikuyu, his view, which I think so many people have taken, is that if the world can accept a Russian writing in Russian, or can take an Argentinian writing in Spanish, why don't they take an African writing in their mother tongue? and then they can translate them like they translate French books and Russian books and Czech books, you know. So it was an important thing, and he explains it in a number of books. Decolonizing the mind was very, very useful in that sense, in terms of explaining it. So all these things he's doing, and those of us who are following are learning, and we're learning. And the fact that, you know, he was clearly was very influential when he dropped his so-called Christian name. His first books were James Goge, then he became Goge Wa Thiong'o, and influenced a lot of people. So they dropped their Christian name and became whatever, you know, their African names, and embracing Africanity and embracing the fact that we have to challenge and question, why do we do things the way we do them? Why do we have our education system in this form? He was critical in at the University of Nairobi when he was teaching there to move the discourse. When he began teaching at the University of Nairobi, it was in the Department of English. And then he changed it. He worked with people, and it became literature in English, the Department of Literature in English. Yeah, so it was amazing. And then he coined the word African literature. And then when he had to run away and to go into exile after the threats to his life, and he went to the UK, was based there. You know, he was a very key part of the dissident or the activist or the pro-democracy movement based in the UK, but also around Europe and North America. And he did that for quite a while. He was so instrumental, so central to it. He then moved to the US, began teaching, but still maintaining activism, wrote a few other novels, Inge Koyo first, then they translated, Shaitani Modaravaine, The Devil on the Cross, wrote quite a few others that were there. And he maintained himself as a real public intellectual in very many ways, challenging, never. So his impact is massive. I mean, it's a massive impact to us as Kenyans. It's a massive loss. The country didn't treat him right or well. As you know, when he came back from exile after being away for 20 odd years, he was attacked in his rental apartment, and his then wife was raped. So it was in 2004. So he has had a very difficult relationship, if you wish, with Kenya. But nevertheless, every time you met him, he was unabashedly and unashamedly Kenyan. So despite the fact that Kenya treated him so badly, he still loved Kenya. He was very patriotic. His patriotism was not the one of flag waving and all that stuff. It was about the people. So he understood a nation is about people. What can we do in whatever our realms of work are, whatever we work or whatever we do, what can we do to uplift our people, the common people, get them a better standard of living, get them to see that they have to stand up, empowerment. So his impact is legendary, and his legacy will live way, 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 way beyond him, beyond the fiction even. I mean, so not only was he a writer of fiction, but he also was an activist and a public intellectual. His impact is massive, and that's across Africa. I mean, I remember when I first started working in the human rights field, I'd meet people from Nigeria and Ghana, and the first thing, oh, you come from Goge Wa Thiong'o, and they talk about the books. So it seemed there was a time when Africans going to school were reading, and I would say, oh yes, you come from Nigeria, the land of Chinua Achebe and Wole Soyinka and all those other writers. Literature was such an important part of our lives as we were growing up, and it taught us different parts of Africa. If anything, the thing that made us start thinking as African was the literature that came out, whether it's Bessie Head from South Africa or other writers that were there. It was making us African. There was a whole push for us to expose young Africans to African literature and African realities. And literature is really a window to the world that we live in, wherever we are at. And it was fantastic to read books that you can recognize places, you know, recognize characters. Oh, I know somebody like that, you know, because they speak in a way that we know. So it was just wonderful in terms of giving us self-confidence and empowering each of us as Africans to stand up and be proud and get confidence. So he did a lot of work to make us confident.
And for you, finally, for you, as a longtime human rights activist, and you knew him as well, the impact on your work, and he was an activist, he was a scholar activist. So how did that impact your work in as you became somewhat contemporaries?
In huge ways. I mean, it grounded me. His work grounded me. Meeting him and talking to him grounded me. He was full of ideas. He was full of stories as well. He challenged us and challenged me in so many ways. When you know, talking about why are we working from Nairobi and why is our work just a documentation from Nairobi? We go in and go out. Why are we not based out in the ground on the ground with ordinary people? So we took the challenge, at least I did, and worked with a group called Inform Action, going out to the villages and talking to ordinary people. And not only talking to them in mother tongue, but also in Kiswahili. And you go out and you meet and you learn from them. And you work. For me, I think one of the biggest impacts he had on my life and my work is that human beings liberate themselves. They're not liberated by those people in the capital cities or in London or in Washington, D.C. or in Stockholm. You know, those ones are supporters. It's not from Nairobi or Blantyre or Dar es Salaam or Abuja. Those will not liberate the country. The country is liberated by the people themselves, wherever they are at. And those local struggles are as important as the national struggles. So you have to be able to combine the two of them and figure out how to bring them together to be able to have an impact across life. So, you know, he was very influential. I have got to say, I mean, it always was very momentous whenever I met him. And in fact, to be honest, I'd be very shy, because I know I'm in the presence of a living legend, if you wish. And it was massive. You want him to sign your books for you, and you are in awe of somebody whose mind can be that broad. A man who can write fiction, you know, fiction by his analysis of where the world is, but he can also write analysis of what's going on and do it well, but also be able to stand up and demonstrate, as he did when he was in London, when he was demonstrating and protesting as an activist and writing the polemics and pamphlets and organizing people so they can come together and fighting for the release of political prisoners after he was released himself. It was fantastic. I mean, so that was really, you know, he was so broad. I don't know, but like every, you know, like every human being, I like to say, you know, we're all human. We all have our flaws and our issues. But on the balance of life, I think he was absolutely wonderful human being.
Mainak, yeah, thank you very much for taking the time to talk about the legendary, renowned Ngugi wa Thiong'o.
Thank you, Mwiza, and thank you. And let's always use these chances to reflect about impact. What is the best impact we, each of us, can have? And to be honest, there's only one Ngugi wa Thiong'o in a generation in a country. So the rest of us, you know, we find our little place, small places like hummingbirds, and do our little jobs and our little things that can move the progressive agenda ahead. And especially now at this day and age where the world is looking so different, you don't even know where the hope is going to come from, where people you have known and worked with for so long all of a sudden join the ranks of the oppressors, and you're thinking, wow, what happened here? You know, so you're seeing all that, and you're seeing your friends, you're seeing countries that you thought would have space and were progressive turning back. The world is so different. And in those two moments, I think reading and going back to those legends, and whether it's Chinua Achebe, it's Ngugi wa Thiong'o, it is Bessie Head, whoever it is, we need to go back and read them, Wole Soyinka, and reflect about this, their view, their perspective on the world from where they sat.
Thanks again, Maina.
Thank you, Mwiza.
Naming and the politics of memory. Kimathi and Kenya, Land and Freedom Army. I have always been fascinated by the encounter between the shipwrecked Crusoe and the native he purportedly rescues from cannibalistic neighbors in Daniel Defoe's novel, Robinson Crusoe. Presumably, this native is also a cannibal, but at no point in the narrative does he make any attempt to consume his rescuer? But it is Crusoe's education program that I find most striking. First, he assumes that the native does not know anything about anything, including their own body. So, unlike Shakespeare's Prospero, the earlier shipwrecked, who takes it that Caliban knows the geography of the island, its fresh springs, its natural endowments, and therefore first seeks that knowledge before turning Caliban into a slave, Crusoe seeks no such things from the native. Instead, he sets out to teach the native. The order of knowledge is most telling. He starts with names. Your name is Friday, because I discovered you on a Friday. And mine is Master. Note, he doesn't say Crusoe. Yours is Friday, and mine is Master. We're to assume that pre-Crusoe Friday had a name by which he identified himself and was identified by his relatives and neighbors. He also had a name by which he identified the things around him, plants, animals, places. Otherwise, communication between him, his relatives, and neighbors would have consisted of a gesture, a la the dwellers of Swift's laughter, who, dispensing the words, carry objects to point at instead of signifying them with sounds. You dispense with language, you just point. We can also assume that names as words, which the native had used before their fatal encounter, must also have acquired a history, a memory around them. And this is what Crusoe erases with his renaming system. Names define relationships to self, other selves, and the environment. So renaming Friday is a barrier of previous identity and histories and a new identities and histories. The new names will forever define the terms of relationship between Crusoe and Friday. That is the discoverer and the discovered, the foreign expert and the native recipient, the knowing expert and the native ignoramus, the naming master and the named native. Naming becomes the rite of conquest, and names the mark of conquest. In my book, Something Torn and New, I have talked a great deal about the politics of memory and the centrality of naming, renaming, misnaming in the power struggle between the subjugating and the subjugated, in our case, the colonizer and colonized. Explorations, preludes to actual colonization of new territories and peoples, went hand in hand with renaming. America had a name or names before Columbus and Amerigo, Canada too, New Zealand, Australia as well. So central was the naming to the colonial process that when one power replaced another, they often re-renamed the same place. That's for a quick example. That's for reason New York had named, or which the pre-colonized natives called it. The Dutch colonial occupant called it New Amsterdam. The English conquerors, or the Dutch, renamed it New York. Not surprisingly, naming has always been a linguistic arm of war, conquest, and subjugations. One obvious way has been the use of terms that dehumanize the opponents. On a small scale, we saw it in full display during the recent American elections. Trump, earlier on, discovered the power of projection of his own negative qualities onto the other. And that's why Jeb Bush became Low Energy Bush, Ted Cruz became Lying Ted, and Hillary Clinton, Crooked Hillary. Some of these carried conviction and consistency because indeed they were projections of his own traits onto others. His followers and even the media came to repeat the terms over and over again. Whatever the repetition of the same, even when the press attributed them to the source, can shape and need shape people's perceptions of the named. The same dehumanization of the other through names happens in all wars on all sides. But in a situation where two sides are matched in power, where indeed they have equally matched machinery of propaganda, the renamings may neutralize each other. Not obviously the case in colonial and anti-colonial wars, in their access to means of propaganda. One side, the colonial state machinery, outmatches the anti-colonial side altogether.
And that was the recording we did of Ngugi wa Thiong'o at the December 16 African Studies Association conference, where he was discussing the politics of memory and the effects of the name imposition on the psychic of colonized people. As you're aware, Ngugi wa Thiong'o, the renowned novelist, essayist, playwright, journalist, editor, academic, and social activist, joined the ancestors last week on May 28. Early on, you heard longtime human rights activist and lawyer Maina Kiai reflecting on the legacy and impact of Ngugi wa Thiong'o. For the full discussion by Ngugi wa Thiong'o, visit African Owl's SoundCloud page. And on our SoundCloud page, you can also see other discussions about Ngugi wa Thiong'o throughout the years of African Owl's presentations. The music in the background is Teacher Don't Teach Me Nonsense by Fela Kuti. That's it for African Hour for today. I'm your host, Muiza Muntali. Up next is Headline News, followed by Shanana with Zain Amin, which looks at issues in Northern Africa and the Middle East, with a particular spotlight on the plight of Palestinians. And that's followed by the women's collective Sophie's Parlor, which is followed by the Browder File with Tony Browder. And that's followed by Black Agenda Radio with Margaret Kimberly, which is followed by Combit Lakai with Eugenia Charles, looking at issues in Haiti. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on X, formerly Twitter, on Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now is archived on iTunes podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope. And thanks to our engineers, Michael Nasella and Clea Chapman. Thanks to our research fellow volunteers, Chanda Kozer and Funangonda, and the Africa World Now Project Collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Erdison. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW and to you for joining us. Continue to support all the great programs on WPFW. We're going to leave you the closing song entitled Harambe by Rita Marley. as we commemorate Caribbean American Heritage Month. Thank you. Have a great day. Have a great week. And stay safe.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Teresa Wersbianska. An Israeli and U.S.-backed group has temporarily paused food delivery at its three distribution sites in Gaza. That came after health officials said dozens of Palestinians were killed in a series of shootings near the sites this week. The Gaza Humanitarian Foundation said today it was in discussions with the Israeli military on better guiding foot traffic near the sites and enhancing military procedures. Jeremy Lawrence is a United Nations human rights spokesperson.
The willful impediment of access to food and other life-sustaining relief supplies for civilians may constitute a war crime. The threat of starvation, together with 20 months of killing of civilians and destruction on a massive scale, repeated forced displacements, intolerable, dehumanizing rhetoric and threats by Israel's leadership to empty the strip of its population also constitute elements of the most serious crimes under international law.
On Tuesday, Israeli forces acknowledged opening fire as people headed towards a distribution hub in Rafah. Gaza health officials, the Red Cross, and the UN Rights Office said 27 people were killed. Witnesses blamed Israeli forces. Ala Ali is a displaced Palestinian.
Honestly, there isn't a single centimeter in the Gaza Strip that's truly safe. But some areas are relatively safer than others. The Israelis call it a safe zone, but in reality, it's not. Every day or two, you see them hitting a tent here or a house there, even a person in a car. There's no safe place in this country.
Israel's military said it fired near people it described as suspects and is looking into reports of casualties. The Trump White House is asking Congress to cancel more than $9 billion in previously approved spending, taking aim at foreign aid and public broadcasting. In a memo released yesterday, Budget Director Russell Vogt said the cuts could target programs the administration calls, quote, antithetical to American interests. That includes funding for the World Health Organization, LGBTQ plus initiatives, clean energy programs, and what it describes as color revolutions abroad. Specifically, the White House wants to slash hundreds of millions from UN peacekeeping, half a billion from global health programs like HIV/AIDS and maternal care, 800 million from refugee assistance, and 125 million from the Clean Technology Fund. This could be the first of several rollback requests headed to Congress. The Secretary of Education, Linda McMahon, defended major spending cuts to outraged Democrats and skeptical Republicans at a Senate budget hearing yesterday. Kennedy Cuello reports.
Secretary of Education Linda McMahon defended the proposed $12 billion budget cut for the Department of Education in the Senate Appropriations Committee Tuesday. The major budget cuts suggest the department's elimination is indeed on the table, but will be a slower process. Ranking Democrat on the Labor, Health and Human Services, Education, and Related Agencies Subcommittee, Senator Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin, focused on the reasoning behind the cuts. She questioned the administration's justification that the cuts are to return the power to the states, saying it is in direct opposition to actions the administration has taken lately.
You claim the administration's goal of eliminating the department is about returning education to the states. At the same time, this administration is attempting to exert more control than ever over the decisions in our schools and campuses. This includes demanding that states certify that they are not implementing DEI, which the department purposefully left vague so it could cut off funding whenever it chooses.
The proposed budget would eliminate TRIO, a collection of programs to help low-income, first-generation, and disabled college students succeed in university. The funding changes are part of a larger budget request